thank you all for being here today. I really appreciate it. It's always nice to see familiar faces and new faces as well. Today we have with us Greg Lukianoff. Since 2001, Greg has been the president of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, whose mission is to defend and sustain individual rights at America's colleges and universities. Significant to our discussion today, Greg is the author of Unlearning Liberty, Campus Censorship, and the End of American Debate, which catalogs, as he has previously described it, just a small fraction of the cases of censorship he's seen over the last decade or so. Greg has published articles in the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, the New York Times, and numerous other publications. He is a blogger at the Huffington Post. He is a frequent guest on local and national syndicated radio programs. He has represented FIRE on national television shows, including the CBS Evening News and the O'Reilly Factor. And he has testified before the U.S. Senate about free speech issues on America's campuses. Please welcome Greg.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I always really enjoy visiting Indiana. I actually really love your roads. I found it incredibly easy to drive here, and I'm not much of a driver. I got bad advice on how long it would take me to get here from my hotel, however, so I apologize for being a little bit late. So I wanted to, open up by talking about why I wrote Unlearning Liberty, Campus Censorship and the End of American Debate. It came out actually in October, just 10 days after I got married, so I had a pretty busy fall. But my background is I'm a First Amendment lawyer, and I'm the weird kid who went to law school specifically to do First Amendment law. I took every class that Stanford Law School offered on First Amendment law, and I even did 6 additional credits on early origins of the prior restraint doctrine coming out of Tudor England. And I remember telling one of my friends about this, and he looks at me in horror and asks me, "Who's making you do that?" And I realized at that point, oh, not everybody loves this as much as me. So I realized it was my calling. But despite doing this, despite having a great knowledge, I even work for the ACLU of Northern California. I'm really familiar with the history of freedom of speech. I'm really familiar with First Amendment law, and I was completely unprepared for the kind of cases I would see at FIRE. I've been doing this now for 11 years, and the kind of censorship you see on college campuses is both sometimes hysterical and also at the same time tragic. And there's another reason why I wrote it is that free speech on campus used to be an issue that united people, at least if they're off campus, united people across the spectrum. When there was the push for speech codes in the supposed heyday of political correctness of the 1990s, there was agreement. The New York Times and the Washington Post and Rush Limbaugh and Gary Trudeau were all making fun of University of Pennsylvania for passing speech codes, and speech codes were defeated in courts of law, and there was a popular misconception that essentially these were greeted disapproval by the public, and they were defeated in the courts of law, and that speech codes just went away. But the problem is now, even though there are more speech codes than there ever were in the 80s and 90s by far, and I'm going to talk about that more in the speech, we've become so polarized as a nation that the question that I get either explicitly or more often implicitly is, what is the politics of the person I'm defending right now? And that's the threshold question for whether or not I should care. Is it an opinion I agree with? Then it should be protected. If it's an opinion I disagree with, who cares? And I get this response from TV producers. I get this response from alums. Once you convince them that there is a problem, they're fine with it as long as it's the other guy who's getting in trouble. And probably the scariest question I got as I was getting ready to write the book was people asking, we have these absurd cases of censorship on college campuses, and I increasingly have been getting the question, why does this matter? And that's a question that really chills me. I think that it's self-evident why that should matter. But I set out in the book to make the argument for why, even if you haven't set foot on a campus in decades, why this is affecting us all, and I'll get to that more towards the end of the speech. But, you know, since this is a room full of lawyers, I thought I should just open up by being very clear about the law. The law, and the law is exceedingly clear. Free speech is protected on public college campuses, period. It is strongly protected on public college campuses. You have cases like Papish from 1973. You have cases like Healy v. James. And then, of course, you have the whole rise of powerful Supreme Court precedents all throughout the 20th century. And there's been more than a dozen, a lot of these challenges FIRE has been part of challenges to university speech codes. Without exception, they get overturned, and handily, every time they're challenged. But nonetheless, most colleges maintain speech codes. So I realized I'm being taped, so I guess actually there was a thing I was going to say more in confidence, but basically we're coming to realize that the incentives on campuses are skewed towards overreaction at the moment, partially due to some bad regulations to the risk management industry, and the fact that universities do get sued sometimes when students are offended, and they're more afraid of those suits than they are of First Amendment suits. So unfortunately, there may have to be some rebalancing. In other words, there may need to be a lot more litigation. And if y'all want to talk to me about that, I'm leaving right for my flight right after this, but my email is greg@thefire.org. Please be in touch, and I'll be posting that up there at the end of the speech too. Okay, so what am I talking about? What am I saying here? Anyone familiar with this case? Okay, so and this is Indiana, guys. Indiana University, Purdue University in Indianapolis. This is a book that celebrates the defeat of the Klan when they marched on Notre Dame. It celebrates the fact that when, because the Klan is also anti-Catholic, that when they marched on Notre Dame, that the students got together and they beat them down and beat them back. It's a very proud story of the defeat of the Klan. And this is a picture related to the March on Notre Dame. It's a historically accurate picture of a really interesting and sad and triumphant at the same time incident in Indiana history. I really have tried to train people never to call me, so it's like email by all means. So a student was reading this book on during his lunch break, and he was found guilty of racial harassment without so much as a hearing. The logic was simply that this cover had offended a student, and there was no way he could defend himself. It's very sad interviewing this student, because he's explaining it's an anti-racist book. It celebrates the defeat of the Klan. How is this racist? Didn't matter. He got no hearing. He was found guilty of racial harassment. And if you have racial harassment on your transcript, people are going to assume you're a Klan member as opposed to reading a book about the defeat of the Klan. Nonetheless, it took the concerted efforts of FIRE and also the Indiana ACLU and the Wall Street Journal to get Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis to finally do away with this finding and ultimately, thankfully, apologize to the student in trouble. But also, so where does this mindset come from? Where does this overreaction come from? And this is one where they can't point to the law. They can't even begin to say, oh, no, the law made us do it. We have an incentive to overreact. This is protected speech. You can read even offensive books in public under the Constitution. But just to show where this mindset comes from, we were sort of done a favor by some professors at Purdue. I just spoke at Purdue 2 days ago. Anybody familiar with this?
Yes.
Okay, so a bunch of engineering students get together and their friends, and they make a hip-hop/rap video about engineering.
And they include the former governor and current president.
Mm-hmm. And Mitch Daniels is in it, yes. And that's who invited me to Purdue. I got to hang out with him actually quite a bit. And Mitch Daniels appears in the video. It is about as innocuous as innocuous gets. It's adorable, really. they make a lot of nerd jokes. They don't necessarily rap all that great or dance all that great, but it's clear that they're doing a good job of this. And the thing that also I find funny about this is that it was. It was almost old-fashioned. It reminded me of, like, New Kids on the Block videos from, like, the 1980s and 90s. Wholesome, as far as I'm concerned. And there was a blistering editorial written by a professor and a graduate student saying that this represents white supremacy, and that these students are racists, and that this should be taken down, and Mitch Daniels should, of course, they're always looking for excuses to punish Mitch Daniels. But in some ways, I'm thankful to them for publishing this op-ed. I did my best to send it all over the world because I was just like, this is the way these people actually think, that essentially all of American culture, and to me, what's so striking about this is I actually really love hip-hop. I listen to tons of hip-hop. My legal director is a former DJ. The fact that hip hop has conquered the world, you can interpret that. I would interpret that as a great success, as something that actually shows that it's a victory for pluralism. But is on campuses, there's a desire to always figure out a way in which everyone else is wrong, everybody else is racist, everybody else is a horror. I'm just glad though that they're willing to put this in print, because now that this article has actually gone. All over the world, when you read the comments, they're all consistently, you are making fools out of yourselves by taking this position. Now, to be clear, I'm a First Amendment lawyer. They obviously have the right to say this. And as I said, but I'm thankful for them to show that they really actually think that students doing this video, what they actually think of that. So, before I get to the next slide, I want to talk about religious liberty issues on campus. I am not personally religious. I make no secret of that. And if you had told me before I worked at FIRE that I would be spending a lot of time defending evangelical Christians on college campuses, I probably would have said, no, that can't be right. That's got to be some kind of like right-wing propaganda. And I had no idea. I had no idea how many different justifications you would find by campus officials to punish, kick off, or otherwise harass evangelical Christians on campus. So, for example, there was a Christian pro-life group at Hopkins that they denied recognition to. We work with George Will wrote an article about this in the Washington Post after talking to us. And that's, honestly, that kind of stuff is par for the course. Meanwhile, they had recognized all sorts of other groups from all over the political spectrum that, were arguably far more controversial than a pro-life group. But nonetheless, not only did they refuse to recognize them, the student newspaper, which had written this wonderfully, thoughtful piece in 2011 saying pro-life students have freedom of speech, and there's a certain amount of course they do. In 2013, that very same newspaper explained how denying the Hopkins pro-life group had nothing to do with free speech. It was such incredible equivocation on their part. And for a student newspaper to not understand free speech is just chilling to me. Now, thankfully, there's a happy ending to this. We just we sent some bad publicity their way. That's the way we roll. The university is back down. The pro-life group is now being recognized. But the fact that they would do this in the first place is part of a trend. One of the longest cases that I was involved in, one of the hardest fights we were involved with, involved a student at University of Wisconsin, first the Eau Claire campus, but then it spread. Evangelical Christian student. He wanted to have a Bible study meeting in his own room at his own time. He wasn't inviting his floor mates there. It was just his friends have Bible study meeting in his own room at his own time. And he was banned from doing so. And he was told, and this is part of the rationale given, was that if people found out you were an evangelical, they might not feel comfortable talking to you. And again, I am not religious, but I had to point this out to them. It's if you had told a Jewish student, for example, saying that we know that you're Jewish, but we have tremendous anti-Semites on the floor, so please be Jewish off campus. I think they'd immediately get that there's something wrong with this, or if they'd said the same thing to a gay RA. So, and I got particularly outraged when I got to meet the student in question in this case, when I got to actually meet the RA they were talking about. One of the nicest, most upstanding kids I've met, and they were saying that that it was just too offensive to other students for him to be having Bible study meetings in his own room at own time. And then, of course, there's the cases going on all over the country right now involving evangelical groups that want to have statements of faith. Statements of faith include where they stand on a variety of issues. They're evangelical groups. They believe homosexuality is sinful. And sometimes they state it as simply as that they believe in traditional marriage. These groups are getting kicked off campus in increasing numbers. And it's ironically oftentimes in the name of pluralism and diversity that they're being kicked off. Most strikingly at Vanderbilt University in Tennessee, where they passed what's called an all-comers policy, which is sort of a loose interpretation of a case called CLS v. Martinez, which is a Supreme Court case, which I think was a bizarre and wrongly decided case, but nonetheless, which said that universities, as long as they apply it across the board, can have a policy saying that belief-based groups are not allowed to discriminate on the basis of belief. And when asked to defend this, what the university administrators were saying was kind of like, so you're saying that the Democrats would have to have Republicans? And they're saying, of course, absolutely, that only makes sense. And one thing that's come out of these cases is that these all originate with people trying to go after the evangelicals. I feel lucky in a sense that I'm first-generation American because I look at this stuff sort of more as an outsider, and I realize that a lot of it comes down to people, sometimes other Christians, just not agreeing with the interpretation of the evangelical's interpretation of religion, completely throwing out the establishment clause or the principles of genuine pluralism. So, and this also just happened at Tufts, where a group just gave up. It's no the Christian Fellowship at Tufts is not a recognized group, and they've given up the fight. So the treatment of religious students, of evangelicals across the country is really striking. Meanwhile, FIRE, you know, we defend everybody. We're the most principled freedom of speech organization out there. And at Louisiana State University, there was a case that was very similar involving the Muslim Student Association. And we wrote them explaining why this is wrong. They can have a statement of faith. They're entitled to their beliefs. And the reaction was just so refreshingly different. They wrote the general counsel wrote back, and we had an exchange, and they started to go, oh yeah, so it's really we really shouldn't be telling religious groups what they should believe. And I remember just being like, yes, and I wish you'd get this with the evangelical Christian groups. You understand that this is wrong when it comes up in the case of the Muslim Student Alliance, but when it was the Christian groups, time and time again, they just don't care. So things are pretty bleak for evangelicals on campus these days, which, as I said, was a surprise to me when I first found it out. Now, and then, of course, there's just the problem of wacky overregulation of campuses. This is a symptom, in my opinion, of the massive over-bureaucratization of universities. There has been a huge expansion in the number of non-teaching administrators on campuses over the past 20 years, and that is part of what you're paying for these days. You're not paying for more professors. You're paying for more and more administrative staff. Sometimes you're paying for a rock wall. Sometimes you're paying for fancier gyms. But you're also paying for these legions of administrators who want to regulate everything, and you end up with absurd results like this. This was just 2 weeks ago. Sinclair Community College in Ohio had a blanket ban on all signs. You could not have protest signs on campus of any kind. And at first it was just saying that not a sign on a stick. At least they had, you know, the argument that you can hurt somebody with a stick, which is a little bit ridiculous as it is. But then they moved over to no signage whatsoever is allowed, so no holding up a poster. And this was all directed at a pro-life group. That being said, to be fair, I guess, to Sinclair Community College, they had this policy in place since the 90s, which is just ridiculous. And when we wrote them, and we wrote them in 2007 saying, this is a ridiculous policy and it's unconstitutional, and they wrote us back a snide letter explaining about how it's not, and you don't understand time, place, and manner restrictions. But when we wrote them back the second time, this is what the university president had to say. In order to defend the use of protest signs on campus, he invoked 9/11 and Virginia Tech. Which to me is, I wrote probably one of the snider titles I've ever given to an article I wrote, but I wrote an article with the title, What Can Virginia Tech Do For Me? And it was meant to be obnoxious, but because I find this offensive. The idea that people would invoke such tragedies so lightly in order to justify such ridiculous censorship, I think is just completely outrageous. And we find universities being willing to pull these cards out for the silliest reasons. I don't think anybody will be surprised to discover that Sinclair lost this lawsuit and settled just last week. But I consider this one of a couplet of cases. We had another one that was right around the same time that settled last summer with University of Cincinnati. University of Cincinnati maintained a free speech zone that was only 0.1% of the entire campus. And not only was it only 0.1% of the entire campus, you had to get 10 days advance state permission in order to use it. So, when a libertarian student group wanted to put out a right-to-work petition, and I like it because it's a particularly enumerated right, the right to petition the government for redress of grievances. I'm like, this is textbook constitutionally protected speech. They were not just told that they couldn't, but they would be arrested if they were seen walking around campus. And amazingly, University of Cincinnati thought this was a really good policy to defend in court. So when we helped facilitate a lawsuit in this case, no shock there, the University of Cincinnati lost. But the idea that they'd want to fight it in the first place is one of the things that I find so incredibly striking. So, and just to be clear that this doesn't just affect conservatives, this is a case that I opened the book talking about. It's something that I could spend the entire time explaining, but just to try to cover it fairly quickly. Environmentalist student doesn't want this parking garage to be put up or at Valdosta State University. Actually, that's just a general picture of a parking garage. He believes that there are more environmentally friendly ways to do it and certainly less expensive ways of doing it, since it worked out to be about $15,000 per parking spot in southern Georgia, which real estate is not wildly expensive. And he'd been respectfully protesting this, letters to the editor, letters to the Board of Regents, by all accounts completely civil. But what he didn't know was that President Ronald Zachary of Valdosta State University had been stopped previously in his attempt to get the parking garage project. And this all came out in discovery. This already was a bad case even without what we found in discovery. But he actually started having meetings about how to get this troublesome student, Hayden Barnes, kicked out. And after somewhere around the third meeting, he discovered this is actually a recreation. It's a very faithful recreation of the collage that he had on Facebook. The real one is just beat up, like it's been Xeroxed a million times. So we got all the images and remade it. He puts after being dressed down by the university president, by the way, for his letter to the editor. It was an hour and a half meeting that this president decided, yeah, it's a good idea for me to dress down this student for opposing my parking garage. He puts this collage up on Facebook that SAVE refers to an environmentalist group on campus that he thought had fallen down in the job, and Zachary Memorial Parking Garage refers to the fact that Zachary had repeatedly talked about how this, it's kind of sad to say, how this parking garage would be part of his legacy. Which is mockworthy, frankly. And, you know, if you've got No Blood for Oil, you've got A Crushed Earth, you know, a liberal fight song, So, any guesses on what the argument for kicking the student out was? It's a death threat, exactly. So after the third meeting, when the and by the way, the other administrators at Valdosta State University were saying this guy is not a threat to anybody. He's a really nice kid, and you can't kick a student out for opposing a parking garage. And he said, "I'm going to do this on my own." And so what he said was, memorials usually happen after people are dead, so this is a threat upon my life. And if anybody's even vaguely inclined to take this argument seriously, the way they went about having this kid kicked out was that they stapled this collage to an expulsion note, referring to him as a clear and present danger, which is adorable in terms of constitutional law, and said that he needed to get psychiatric evaluations immediately, and they slipped it under his door. And said that he had 48 hours to be out. And I'm sorry, if you think someone is an actual threat to your life, you don't slip a note under their door saying, be out in 48 hours. And what is funny is the student immediately got psychological evaluations. He immediately went and got them faster than he was required to. He got two psychologists saying, this student is not a threat to himself or anybody else. And what makes it even just juicier of a case is the guy is a Shambhala Buddhist, he's a believer in nonviolence, and he's a decorated EMT. Decorated EMT, like that. People who do stuff that would scare most of us. So they picked an unimpeachable person. But the scariest thing about this case overall is that this was such a clear case, and it was so obvious. But faculty did not come to this student's defense. Students did not come to this student's defense. We barely found out about this case. And we know that there are cases like this happening all over the country. And one of the reasons why I also like this case is it shows why we should all defend free speech, because it takes people about 15 minutes to realize, oh, this is an exception to free speech. How can I make this work for me? How can I use this to punish people who disagree with me? And it's amazing how quickly people put that together. So, and remember me talking about how every single speech code that's ever been challenged has been defeated in a court of law? That is the latest stats that we've come up with. We have a full-time devoted attorney, Penn Law graduate. She's one of the most meticulous people I've ever met in my life. She's perfect for this job. And she's been evaluating speech codes on campus now for years. Of the top 400 schools in the country, we found that 62.1% this year maintain what we call red light speech codes. Red light speech codes, to put as simply as possible, are codes that are laughably unconstitutional, not even a close call. And all of the codes that have been defeated in fire organized lawsuits have been red light speech codes, and they've all been handily defeated. What do I mean when I say red light speech codes? A great example, an example I like to use often because it came back, it had an interesting history. University of Connecticut was had its speech code overturned in an unpublished opinion. I hate unpublished opinions. I think in 1991, because they had a speech code, usually, and these are almost always phrased as harassment, but then they define harassment as being anything that offends, which is, of course, not the legal definition of harassment. But they included in it that harassment included inconsiderate jokes and yeah, and inappropriately directed laughter. Yeah. And so that got defeated in court of law, got laughed at by the public, rightfully, maybe inappropriately directed as far as they're concerned. But amazingly, that code came back up at Drexel University. Someone decided, this looks like a great one, and basically like reprinted it verbatim at Drexel University in Pennsylvania and Philadelphia, and we defeated that code. But it's just one after the other. Florida Gulf Coast University, and my mom's British, so this appeals to me at a certain level, they have a code that bans simply expressions deemed inappropriate, which is just incredibly vague, incredibly broad, and one of the things I always try to point out is that students, they're okay with having these codes that, by their plain language, every single student is guilty of violating. By their plain, they're so broad that every single student could be brought up on charges on them, but they're okay with them because they don't believe it's going to be enforced against them until it is. And I think that these codes also, I think that's one of the reasons why when you talk to students on campus these days, they falsely believe that a lot of speech that is flatly protected is not in fact protected, because they're being miseducated by the prevalence of all of these speech codes. And now to probably the creepiest stuff that's going on in college campuses. This is what's called the power and control wheel, and I'll explain what it's from. Michigan State University had this nicely called program called the Student Accountability and Community Program. The idea was to have an early intervention for students who showed aggressive behavior. And I have to explain what this program actually ended up being. Now, when I first, I went to a seminar on this, and they were trying to get the whole country to adopt this program. And I'm sitting there looking at this whiteboard where they've written a chart, and down here they have practical jokes, and up there they have assault and rape. And I'm looking at this and going, please tell me they're not going to say what I think they're going to say. Please tell me they're not going to say what I think they're going to say. And lo and behold, what they said was, we've noticed that students who tend to commit these crimes, assault and rape, tend to start with these crimes, practical jokes. Now, first of all, that's, to my knowledge, that's just not true. But also at the same time, it's like, but the whole idea was that kind of like we have to go after students early as an early intervention, and so they really targeted just any kind of aggressive behavior whatsoever for this early intervention, and they gave an example, and they were proud of this example. There was a girl who got into a fight with her boyfriend and slammed a door, and she got sentenced to mandatory SAC training, and they were proud of this. Because what they explained was originally it had just been for men. Originally the program had just been designed for men, and they were saying, "Oh well, but we also punish girls." And I'm like, "And you're proud of that?" Like, so they had they explained what the sessions involved. And Orwellian is a word that is done to death. People use it way too often, but this is right out of Orwell. You sit down in a chair in front of a non-psychologist, but someone who's trained in SAC, the Student Accountability and Community Program, and they ask you what you did. And they gave the example of a student who had been rude to a receptionist. And when he asked what he did, he said, I was rude to a receptionist. I'm very sorry. I should not have been rude to the receptionist. But that's not the right answer. And they won't tell you what the right answer is, but you have to say it. Then you're given the power and control wheel, and you're supposed to circle if you used your economic privilege, or if you used your, or if this is a form of sexual abuse, or if you're using isolation. So you go through, and it's four sessions. So you have to pay $50 to do it, or they put a hold on your account, which means effectively you're expelled. And then the next session, they give you the wheel of empowerment, which I don't have here, but that includes ideas like making joint economic decisions with people. Like it's one of these incredibly prescriptive ideas of like, this is the way you should live your life. But you're not allowed to finish the program until you say what you did wrong the way they want you to say it. And any guesses on what the correct answer was that will get you out of psychological counseling? I felt entitled to be in the dormitories, and that was wrong. Now, given the ridiculous prices that most universities charge for their tiny little rooms, he was entitled to be in the dormitory. He just shouldn't have been rude to a receptionist. It could have been resolved that easily. But even creepier than this, and I urge you to go to thefire.org and watch this video, the University of Delaware program, again, I could spend an entire session talking about this. This was literally referred to as a treatment for all 7,000 students in the dorms. It included a speech code that placed offensive remarks on the same level of seriousness as theft and assault and vandalism, and included mandatory floor programs in which you would go to this meeting, and they were very clear that these were mandatory, and they'd talk about different social issues, and if you were on one side of, say, they talked about eating disorders, they talked about affirmative action, they talked about welfare, they talked about, you know, all of those sort of hot-button issues. And if you had one opinion on it, you went to that wall. And if you had the wrong opinion, you went to that wall. Basically like a puritanical public shaming of people with wrong points of view. And I think probably one of the most heartless examples of this was there was a student who actually did have an eating disorder, and she'd struggled with it. And the question was whether or not it's socially constructed or if it's something that's more of a personal tendency, if it's more of a personal problem. And of course the right answer, by the way, is it's socially constructed. That's the one that they wanted. But when the girl objected to the idea of being in it because she didn't think it was that simple, she was told there are no, you have to choose sides in the real world. There is no being in between, so get on one wall or the other. And I think that it's just intellectually bereft to say that there is no middle. But the creepiest thing of all that came out of this program And he really, I can't do it justice. You really have to watch the video on this and read the section of the book about it. But there are these creepy one-on-one sessions that you had with your RA that you're required to go to, that included questionnaires about what races and sexes you would date, and you were supposed to fill these out. So, and this is all written up in their own materials. A female freshman and a third year RA, a junior RA male. You know, they're in his room, and you can't really blame the guy too much because he's required to do this. He gives her the questionnaire about what races and sexes she would date. And one of the mandatory questions is, when did you discover your sexual identity? To which she answered, none of your damn business. And she got written up as the worst student, and her name and room number was published within Residence Life. Her giving completely the right response to a state official who's asking you about your sex life was actually the thing that they considered the great wrong. So these attempts to the lack of recognition of the right of private conscience on campus is something that is some of the scariest stuff of all. So. And I think that this is having, I think all those shenanigans that we see on campus is having real results. This is a study of 24,000 college students and 9,000 campus professionals, which also includes, and the campus professionals also included university professors. They were asked this milquetoast question, is it safe to hold unpopular positions on campus? This is the American Association of Colleges and Universities, venerated, one of the oldest university groups in the country. And they asked this milquetoast question, in my opinion, because they wanted a whitewash. They wanted to be able to say, you know, we asked this question and everybody said, of course it's safe to hold unpopular points of view on campus. If you really want to know, is it safe to discuss them? Is it safe to bring them up? Is it safe to engage in devil's advocacy or thought experimentation? You would have phrased it differently if you wanted a real answer to it. But even with this ridiculously softball of a question, only 40% of university freshmen strongly agreed with the statement that it is safe to merely hold unpopular views on campus. And those are the optimists. By the time you get to senior year, it's all the way down to 30%. Only 30% of college seniors strongly agreed with the statement that it's safe to merely hold unpopular points of view on campus. And by the way, if you think it's kind of sort of maybe safe to hold unpopular views on campus, that means you don't think it's safe to hold unpopular views on campus. But even more tellingly, as you get to campus professionals, 18.7% of them strongly agreed with the statement that it's safe to hold unpopular points of view on campus. And underneath that number is only 16.7% of university professors think it's safe to hold unpopular points of view on campus. This to me is particularly striking in light of the fact that I think that students have learned, you know, some real lessons. You don't talk to the people you disagree with. You don't bother disagreeing. You join the groups that you're already ideologically suited for, and don't bother disagreeing with your highly opinionated, fragile egoed professors. And if you follow those rules, that's why I think if you talk to most students today, they'll say, "Oh, censorship isn't a problem on campus." It's like, yes, if you don't talk to people you disagree with, don't stay within your ideological group, and don't challenge professors, then sure, you're going to be completely fine. The only problem is that's what's wrong with our entire society. it creates, and there are two more studies that I found interesting, but since I'm headed in the direction for this one, really tellingly, Diana Muntz wrote a book called Hearing the Other Side. And she found an inverse correlation between how much education you have and how many political disagreements you have in the course of a week or a month. In other words, if you only have a high school education, you tend to have a lot. If you've gone to college, you have fewer. And if you have PhDs, you have the fewest. So in other words, the more education you have, the thicker your echo chamber becomes. And also, of course, there's the problem of the silent classroom phenomena, which I've read about in the New York Times the first time back in 2002, and all this hand-wringing about why are students so reticent about talking in class? Why don't they feel free to disagree? And they talk about all of these, in some cases, legitimate ideas about millennials, about, you know, politeness and this kind of stuff. and the principle of subjectivity. But then they came up with really goofy ones, like stuff related to Oprah and stuff related to Crossfire and the Monica Lewinsky affair. Never mentioning the fact that they know they can get in trouble if they say the wrong thing on campus. That surely is one of the reasons why they're not bothering. They either can get graded down or sometimes, as I've shown in case after case, flat out in trouble, actually face a threat to their career. And you can't really hope for things to get better while this is still the case. So just to... what I'm trying to, you know, point out are the two distinct ways in which I think campus censorship hurts us all, even if we're off campus. This is the subtler one that I think people don't quite get. It encourages people to stay within their echo chambers. It encourages people, and the research on that is incredibly clear. If you only talk to people you agree with, you tend to become much surer in your opinion. You tend to become much more radical in your opinion. And when asked about what the opinions are of other people are on that topic, they often have no clue. They simply don't know where other people are coming from. And this is a problem that's in our society that's getting worse. Higher education could be helping us overcome this problem. But if you can get in trouble for having the wrong opinion on campus, they're only making it worse. And I think this is a tremendously missed opportunity. So I think it accelerates political polarization. I think it also, the censorship on campus also encourages really bad thinking about what it means to live in a free society. I was on NPR recently, and there was a student who... how much time?
15 minutes.
Oh, that's plenty, okay. And she was there to defend free speech on her campus, and she seemed very pro. And at one point she was asked about what policies they have, and she said, without even thinking about it, well, if we have a free speech zone, and you have to apply for it 10 days in advance, but they enforce it fairly. And I was like, ugh. Like this, students today are much too comfortable being told what they can say, where they can say it, and that they need permission from the state in order to do it. This is not thinking like a free people. This is like thinking like censors. And that's one of the things that scares me the most. Alan Charles Kors, I think, said it best, that a nation that does not educate in liberty will not long endure in liberty and will not even know when it is lost.
Amen.
And I think that, and I really think that the other side of that is that students are learning the wrong lessons, and I think that the subtler harms are all there, but the other side of it, that it's safe to keep your nose clean, is... also the problem of the censors have taken on the mantle of heroes on campus. They're the romantic heroes. They're the ones with the moral high ground. And a great example of a teacher literally teaching this is Sally Jacobson at Northern Kentucky University. This was a pro-life display, little crosses. It was approved by the university. It was in a little corner of the university. And Sally Jacobson sees it, goes in front of her class, and says, "I'm offended by this, and I think we should exercise our free speech rights to destroy this display." And she brings her students out, and she rampages through it, tears them up, breaks them, and throws them in the trash. And she wasn't just making stuff up. She honestly believed she had a right not to be offended. When asked later, she still believed it was a First Amendment right to be able to destroy someone else's display. And the problem is students are actually learning the lesson. When students put up free speech walls across the country, these are white sheets of paper where you can write whatever you want, and it's a great sociological experiment because it makes the point that when you really let people talk, it's not nearly as terrifying as you think it's going to be. I mean, sure, they're students, so there's a fair amount of swears, but, you know, that's the way students talk. But they're, you know, sometimes they're incredibly witty. Sometimes they have great quotes. I thought one of the funniest ones was when somebody had put up the salary of the university president, which I thought was kind of great. And if people say offensive things, you just respond to it on the wall. And it works out great. And for every, you know, bad comment, there's five people arguing back. It shows that free speech actually works. But in case after case, students, and in some cases professors, tear these things down. And the most shocking case I've seen of this, but also the most telling case, happened in Canada, where a student tore down a free speech wall And he was a gay student, and he said the free speech wall was offensive. The only thing that he could have argued was offensive on it to gays was that it said someone had written traditional marriage is awesome. That's the worst thing that was written on it. But that wasn't his point. He tore down the free speech wall, not because there was anything bad written on it, but because there could be. And he portrayed himself as a hero. He wrote about this on Facebook. He was sort of publicizing his grand stance against free speech. And it was really striking to me, first of all, how much applause he got for it. How many people were saying, you know, right on. But in general, you know, the normal dynamic is that, you know, people, Americans at least, love free speech in theory, don't always love it in practice. And that makes some amount of sense. But the move now is to hate free speech even in theory. And that's what this student was saying, is that free speech is the enemy of progress, without understanding that it's the ultimate protector of oddballs, dissenters, and was put in the Constitution specifically to protect minority rights. Majority rights in a democracy are protected by the democracy. You don't need a First Amendment to protect the majority rights. The First Amendment is there to protect minority rights, but universities have so badly miseducated students that they actually have come to see free speech as the enemy of progress as opposed to an essential component of it. So here's your homework. I would love for you to read the book and spread the word about it. And keep in mind, I'm not making a penny off this thing. All the royalties go to FIRE, Foundation for Individual Rights Education. Check out your alma mater's policies at thefire.org. We have over 400 top schools listed. Chances are your alma mater's on there. We're really nice to schools that get on the green light list. If they get rid of their speech codes, we celebrate them in the Huffington Post. We celebrate them everywhere, and we're suddenly we become very, very nice if they work with us and pass good codes. Join FIRE's legal network. We have a network of attorneys. You know, please support FIRE, hardest working nonprofit out there. And fight back. We don't have to accept campus speech codes and censorship as the new normal. So I'm happy to take questions if there's still some time.